Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and today I'm delighted to say that I am joined by Corey Shacker. Dr. Shacker is a Senior Fellow and the Director of Foreign and Defence Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. She has a remarkable CV, having worked at the US State Department, the US Department of Defence, and the National Security Council at the White House. She's also the author of multiple books, most recently America versus the West, Can the Liberal World Order Be Preserved? And she has also contributed a fascinating essay to an extraordinary collection called The New Makers of Modern Strategy, From the Ancient World to the Digital Age, and that's published by Princeton University Press. The essay in question is called Strategic Excellence, Tecumseh and the Shawnee Confederacy. Well, hello, Corey. Welcome.
It's such a joy to be having this conversation, Paul. Thank you for giving me the chance.
Our pleasure. Now, there's a lot of talk in the US, and not just in the US, about notions such as common purpose, about how you bring people together to attain specific goals. Now, it's pretty rare, unusual, I suppose, in a country that has the extraordinary diversity of the United States to have these things harnessed at any one time. And yet, Corey, you argue that there is one powerful such precedent. It's one not terribly well known, certainly outside the United States, when Americans did come together to design and execute a strategy with political, religious, economic, diplomatic, and military elements, which was able for at least a while to deal with the external issues threatening them. And this extraordinary example is that of the Shawnee Confederacy, which lasted for about 6 years, between 1807 and 1813, in the relatively early years of the American Republic. So, Corey, what was the Shawnee Confederacy and who was Tecumseh?
So the Shawnee Confederacy was an alliance of Native American tribes that ranged geographically from Lake Erie in the north on the Canadian border with the United States to the Gulf of Mexico in the south. And because of their tight alliance, they had, in fact, America's first Article 5 commitment to reinforce each other when confronted with American settlers moving into their hunting and living areas. They created a north-south line of Native militancy against further settler expansion along the whole of the North American landmass, something that had not been achieved before and wouldn't ever be achieved again. Their resistance ran from Lake Erie to the Gulf, a distance of 1,200 miles.
It's extraordinary.
They put together the largest Native fighting force and produced a military capable of defeating the United States government. The Shawnee imposed the largest combat losses the U.S. forces had known and precipitated a doubling in size of the American army. And it was the last time that Native Americans had any reasonable prospect of preventing European American domination of the continent.
And what was the historical context for this? Because I think in your essay, you talk about more than 900 military actions against American Indians, Native Americans between 1768 to the end of roughly the end of the 19th century. And so what was the context of that? Because the British and American, the Treaty of Paris, in which Britain ceded independence to the 13 American colonies, also ceded sovereignty, you write, of the entire Transappalachian region. That's the area south of the Great Lakes, north of Florida, and importantly, east of the Mississippi. So what was the challenge there? How did this come about?
It goes back even before American independence, when George III committed that settlers would not expand beyond the Appalachian Mountains in the West. And the problem that President George Washington has once we have a United States is the perennial problem. It's the problem George III had. It's the problem every American president faced, which is they could not prevent American settlers from violating the government's treaties with Native American tribes and moving in to live in territory sovereign to Native American tribes. As you rightly said, Paul, the frontier wars were endemic. There were 943 military campaigns against Native Americans in that 150 years or so. At the time Europeans land in North America, there were 5 million Native Americans living here, organized into 500 tribes, many of them as distinct from each other as they were from Europeans. And I mentioned that to give a sense of just how consequential a political feat Tecumseh and the Shawnee pulled off by organizing tribes into a unified front in order to try and prevent militant American settlers from violating those treaties and taking their land.
And tell us something about Tecumseh himself. I know that great man history is not terribly fashionable these days, and
it's not fashionable, but it's so true in this case.
Well, make your case, Corey.
His main adversary, William Henry Harrison, who was the governor of what was then known as the Northwest Territories, which was what now constitutes about five different states in the American Union: Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Harrison describes him in this way: the impatient obedience and respect which the followers of Tecumseh pay to him is really astonishing, and more than any other circumstance bespeaks him one of those uncommon geniuses which spring up occasionally to produce revolutions and overthrow the established order of things. If it were not for the vicinity of the United States, he would perhaps be the founder of an empire that would rival in glory that of Mexico or Peru. No. And what Tecumseh did, I mean, it's pointless to ask where was he radicalized, because he was always radical, because he lived a life where he was fighting the westward expansion of European Americans from the time he was a child. What he did so brilliantly was use religious and social means to radicalize and unify Native American tribes, forcing out peacetime leaders, replacing them with war chiefs, which was not commonly done in Native American communities. He popularized an economic model resistant to land cessation, developed a foreign policy that provided sustenance to communities while freeing up men to fight, and those fighters were successful on the battlefield. The elements were mutually reinforcing, each strengthening the other. And what the Shawnee under Tecumseh did was maximize their prospects of success by shrewd orchestration of all available means. And that's why I think it's such an excellent example of strategy. And the sadness, I hope I don't preempt something you were going to say later, but the tragedy of this story is a tragedy of strategy, which is that this elegant and effective strategy was overcome by superior resources.
Mm-hmm. So it was an economic victory rather than a military one or anything else.
That's exactly right. Mm. If one lesson from it is that superior resources, which tends to be American government strategy in every war we fight, right? We just overwhelm with money, with troops, with food. And what happens in the case of the Shawnee is that, you know, a smart naval officer named Perry figures out that the support, that freeing up warriors to fight required the British to feed those native communities, and he cuts the supply lines. Mm-hmm. And in the long term, the defeat of every Native American tribe is the sheer number of settlers willing to risk their lives and the lives of their families in order to have a plot of land that's their own.
So a question that arises out of that is the relationship between the Shawnee and the Confederate self, and Tecumseh, of course, and the British, and then the relationship with the United States, this fledgling United States at the time, really, I suppose. What's the relationship there? What are the British trying to achieve in this context?
Well, North America is a backwater in British strategic priorities in this time period, so roughly 1795 to 1813. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, Britain's fighting on the European continent at for much bigger stakes and against a much bigger adversary in the form of Napoleon. And what's happening in North America is a backwater. I mean, you have the fledgling American states just pulling together under George Washington's presidency. Mm-hmm. And you have the War of 1812 perking up because Britain's impressing sailors and trying to blockade resources from going to assist Napoleon. So Britain's got bigger issues on its plate.
Yeah.
And so it's an economy of force theater for Britain. They have a small contingent of forces in Canada that they can bring to bear. But what the association with the Shawnee Confederacy does for Britain is it gives Britain the ability to impose a two-front war on the United States, because with British aid and assistance, the Shawnee are fighting in the West in an unconnected theater with what the United States government is fighting in the East, in Canada, in Florida. And the Shawnee uprising required bleeding troops away from the Eastern and Southern front in order to hold the Northwest Territory.
One of the interesting things you make about this range of qualities that Tecumseh brings to this is this religious ideas. What mm-hmm. sort of religious beliefs are we talking about with Tecumseh, Shawnee, and the other peoples within the Confederacy?
It's a sort of naturalistic religion, actually kind of similar to Shinto practiced by Japanese.
Okay, so there's a level of ancestor worship there.
A lot of kind of communing with nature, and it was ridiculed by white settlers. But actually the Shawnee Confederacy begins with its religious roots, and not under Tecumseh, but under his brother, Tenskwatawa. Mm. And there's this famous confrontation that actually gets a lot of the original impetus to in the Confederacy comes when William Henry Harrison, the governor of the Northwest Territories, ridicules the religious beliefs of the Shawnee and says, you know, if you're so in touch with nature, make the sun stand still. And Tenskwatawa and the Shawnee were knowledgeable enough about the movements of the heavens that they chose a day of an eclipse to prove it. And it very strongly seemed to reinforce their claim to have a connection to a higher power that was supporting their political objectives.
And the Shawnee, were they aware, was part of their drive, a realization that this was an existential conflict?
Absolutely. You know, you had already seen an enormous amount of friction between settlers south of the Ohio River, so in Kentucky, Georgia. You'd already seen a lot of friction between those settlers and the five native tribes, the Creek, the Cherokee, what European Americans call the five civilized tribes. And they're called that because they were living in the same ways white settlers in their midst were. They were settled hunters and farmers. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't obvious early on that the two communities would be incompatible. But it begins to dawn on Native American tribes. You see the collapse of the incredible Iroquois Confederacy, you know, the most interesting democracy in North America at the time, collapses under aggression from settler communities. You can see the Native American tribes in Florida agitating against Spanish control in Florida. And you see the pushing westward of settlement. So Tecumseh organizes, you know, he recruits on the basis that, you know, these whites claim they are Christians and yet they crucified their God. They are putting black people in chains, and we are going to be in chains next. Land that had been protected by treaty is being confiscated by force. So yeah, they absolutely see it as existential. And that's why in 1805, Tecumseh succeeds in converting Shawnee, Iroquois, Chickamauga, Mesquite, Miami, Mingo, Ojibwa, Ottawa, Kickapoo, Lenape, Delaware, Mascouten, Potawatomi, Sauk, Tutelo, and Wyandot tribes all into the Confederacy. And it's a major threat to the ability of settlers to remain where they are rather than be pushed back. And to give a sense of the magnitude of what they almost succeed at, that this, you know, the imposition of Native American force from Lake Erie to the Gulf of Mexico, it would have foreclosed European settlement west of Ohio. It would have denied the use of the Mississippi River as an economic engine of U.S. development, prevented utilization of the West's natural resources, right? The gold, silver, and everything else that comes from the West and finances the American government, and constrained the United States to an eastern seaboard country rather than a continent-spanning behemoth.
And could there have been, possibly, I mean, we're talking counterfactuals now, but could there have been a possibility of settling from the West as there was? So there was almost like a pincher movement of settlers.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. And in fact, that is how the United States is settled. It pushes in from both coasts, but it doesn't happen simultaneously.
Yeah.
The push westward from the Alleghenies to the Mississippi and beyond happens first. And then the movement from the West through Utah and into the Great Plains happens between 30 and 50 years later. So if the Shawnee could have established an eastward facing barricade, they would have had the time to pivot to the West.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. the geographical scale of this, you presented very eloquently, the 1,200 miles all the way from what is now the Canadian border down to the Gulf of Mexico. That is a vast space. And it says something remarkable about Tecumseh, that he could lead what was originally a very diverse and potentially conflicted Confederacy, I presume. And there's one piece of one of his speeches. You quote one of his speeches there, and indeed compare him rather favourably to Herodotus. And I think you get that sense of how urgent his programme was, his project was, when he starts to criticise very publicly other tribes who he wants to draw into the Confederacy. And so he talks about other tribes who disappeared, and he speaks, this is quoting Tecumseh now, "They have vanished before the avarice and oppression of the white men. The white usurpation in our common country must be stopped, or we, its rightful owners, will be forever destroyed and wiped out as a race of people. I'm now at the head of many warriors, backed by the strong arm of English soldiers. Let us form one body, one heart, and defend to the last warrior our country, our liberty, and the graves of our fathers. Choctaws and Chickasaws, you are among the few of our race who sit indolently at ease." Now, that's a magnificent piece of oratory.
Isn't that amazing and incredible, inspiring?
But I see why talking about... I said Herodotus, didn't I? You compared it to Thucydides, of course. And you could take that straight out of the account of the Peloponnesian War.
Yeah, and we actually have first-person accounts of Tecumseh trying to recruit tribes and consolidating their support, because William Henry Harrison, the governor of the Northwest Territories, gets all of the tribes together to try and break the... He has several of these meetings with all of the leadership of the various tribes to try and break the solidarity. And Tecumseh shows up and uses it as a recruiting tool. And Harrison has stenographers taking down every word Tecumseh is saying in his native language and then translating them to send to the Secretary of War back in Washington, as Harrison is arguing, "I need more forces. We are losing ground. We're being defeated on the battlefield, and we are facing a political force of increasing momentum, and we have to break it down." Harrison fails to break the solidarity in these conventions. And so while Tecumseh is off recruiting, Harrison burns Prophetstown, the place, the location, the enormous city where all of the tribes were gathering. And what it served to do, as so often the indiscriminate use of force serves to do, was reinforce the commitment of Native Americans. Harrison even acknowledges that Tecumseh had successfully united the Confederation and was the sole leader who could deliver their agreement to any treaty or their force in any battle after he burns Prophetstown.
And what age was he at the time?
I don't even know, but young.
Yeah. Yeah,
probably in his late 20s.
Yeah. Oh, God, really young. Like a little bit like Alexander, one might say. But the Prophetstown, I find absolutely fascinating. Can you give us a description of Prophetstown? I mean, where it was, what it was like, how many people were there?
It's along a river in Indiana. They have more than 5,000 families organized there at the time. And it's a religious community. It's a political community. It's a huge city of the time, and there's nothing comparable to it before or after in Native organization.
And we get any sense?
I have the figures in the I have the figures in the book, but I don't remember them off the top of my head.
Do we get any sense of what it looked like?
Yeah, it would look like Native American huts. The Plains Indians have teepees, mm-hmm. but the Indians east of the Mississippi have tents and build huts and have communal lodges.
Yeah.
You know, this is such a large and diverse collection of tribes that they don't have unified housing because they're all caring for themselves. There aren't public works in Prophetstown.
Mm-hmm. Was there a point?
But it's enormous. It would have stretched miles along the river before Harrison burns it all to the ground.
Was the burning of Prophetstown at the end of the campaign?
No, it's actually before the great military victories. There are still tribes that buy into the religious unity and the political unity and have stopped using European cloth and weapons and food, but who are recalcitrant about fighting an existential war. Mm-hmm. Prophetstown unifies them behind the military mission.
Right.
And it's only after Prophetstown that you get the military victories at the Kennard River, Brownstown, Monongahela, and Fort Detroit, where the Shawnee are backed by the British and burning American forts. You know, while U.S. forces are invading Canada in the east, the Shawnee and the British take the forts all along the western frontier. Just to take one example, in the 1813 Battle of River Raisin, the Shawnee Confederacy have such a decisive victory that they destroy the entire 800 of the Confederacy, destroy the entire United States Army force, militia, and settlers, only 33 soldiers escaping with their lives. William Henry Harrison, who wasn't present at the battle, but he was the reinforcing force that rushes, that doesn't arrive in time to salvage the engagement, he calls it a national calamity.
But soon after that national calamity for the United States is reversed.
Yeah. At the battle in 1813, the Battle of the Thames, which is along the border close to the Canadian border, mm-hmm. And at which Tecumseh, so just before the Battle of the Thames, Perry cuts the supply lines. So fighters on the front begin to hear from their families that they're starving. And so that shakes the possibility of continued support. But the real death blow, the literal death blow, is Tecumseh being killed at the Battle of the Thames. Mm-hmm. And nobody who's not him, especially under the circumstances of the cut of supply to communities, nobody can hold the Confederacy together.
Which reinforces your great man theory.
Absolutely right. I mean, Harrison's after action report to the Secretary of War concluded at the Battle of the Thames that the British had only inflicted 3 American casualties in the battle. All the other American casualties were inflicted by Native troops. And the reason he could tell that is that the Shawnee fight predominantly with hatchets, bows, and arrows. They could fire 7 arrows a minute, and it took American soldiers of that time, remember this is before rifled muskets and before breech-loading muskets. So it takes 2 to 3 minutes for an American soldier to reload a musket, and then Native tribes can fire 7 arrows in a minute.
Mm. It's rather similar to the longbow at Agincourt, I suppose.
Oh, that's a great parallel. That's a great parallel.
And so this was the end, essentially, of the Shawnee Confederacy. Yes. And really the end of any genuine prospect of Native Americans turning back this tide of domination by settlers in what would become the United States.
That's right. And it's not only the last time you get this, an organizer and a leader who can inspire that kind of connectivity and can provide the battle leadership and the credibility of support across tribal boundaries. So it not only fractures that and nobody else can ever manage it, but it also casts a long shadow. You know, the governor of Michigan, Lewis Cass, during the Shawnee Confederacy, he becomes the Secretary of War in Andrew Jackson's administration in 1828. And he's who prosecutes the Indian Removal Act. So Cass becomes convinced during the Shawnee Confederacy that Native American tribes and white settlers cannot live in peace, that the Native Americans are too big a threat to the westward expansion of European American settlers and too big a danger to them. And so 46,000 Native Americans are forcibly depopulated from their 25 million acres of homes and hunting grounds to reservations west of the Mississippi. What is now the state of Oklahoma was designated as Indian territory to physically remove them from the space that white settlers wanted for their own.
And how is Tecumseh viewed now in the United States? What's his legacy?
Yeah, so I would offer two proofs of the admiration that people knowledgeable of the period have. The first is, if you were to go to the National Gallery of American Art, one of the Smithsonian museums here in Washington, you would see an exquisite marble statue of the dying Tecumseh. And it is redolent of the dying of Native American prospects for retaining their territory and retaining their lifestyle. So go see the dying Tecumseh. But I guess the one that gives the most accurate fingerprint is that General William Sherman, one of the great heroes of preservation of the American Union during the Civil War, his father, who lived in the Northwest Territories, named William Sherman for Tecumseh. His full name is William Tecumseh Sherman, in admiration of both the political and battlefield achievements of that great Shawnee leader.
That's a remarkable sign of respect, really, isn't it? And what are there any lessons we can draw from this rather remarkable episode in American history?
I think two. The first is that even the most elegant and mutually reinforcing strategy can be overcome by superior resources. Mm-hmm. And second, you know, just as Tom Schelling, when he was working out game theory for the strategy of nuclear weapons, understood that if you're only playing one round, you behave differently than if you're playing subsequent rounds. And I think the lesson of the failure of the Shawnee Confederacy is it convinced white Americans that that living side by side in peace was impossible, and leads to the genocide of Native American societies.
Well, thank you, Corrie. It's an extraordinary story, and You told it so well and typically incisive about the lessons to be learned from that. So thank you enormously for coming on and talking to AI Talks. Thank you. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.